If an animal feels rage, it's so it will attack. So if a human being, and this could happen with animals too, but we don't really know. Anyway, but with a human being, it's also an animal. If as a child, it feels rage, but it's powerless to act on the rage. Like the fear is greater than the rage. You can have two emotions at the same time. Then the rage gets turned inward, suppressed, shut off, and so on and so forth. And then there'll be a part of that person that was seeking an outlet for the rage, that would entail an experience of having power over somebody weaker. And the pleasure would have to do with actually being able to own or release the rage, even if it didn't come out as actual rage. Like when I was watching those violent images against women, which you know about from Seen and Not Seen, I was not aware of any anger. It was a purely bodily thing, like I felt. But I could say I was aware of a feeling of power, even though I didn't think about it. But because that was the nature of the imagery that I was watching, was one was a man overpowering a woman generally.
So where would everyone we've been talking about fall into that power? I mean, Frank.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Well, Frank, we see it, him enacting it. Like he actually kidnaps Dorothy's husband so that he has complete power over her. She'll do anything that he wants. And then he comes around and then he enacts, and he even says baby wants to fuck. So he's even regressing to an infant state of powerlessness and being powerful in that state.
And then Travis is... I mean,
well, we see he's powerless to connect. He's powerless to communicate.
And to do something, just to be able to to say something, to do something, to be heard.
Even to sleep, he can't even sleep.
And he does. I'm thinking about Kevin. Because it seems more, even more detached than that with Kevin. Because it's...
Well, Kevin hates his mother.
And the whole thing is rage against his mother. It's like the people, it's like the power that he has over them is insignificant almost. It's like he can't, there's no possibility of him not having power over them. So it's like he doesn't even enjoy it. He wouldn't even enjoy that necessarily because they're... It's so easy for him.
The kids that he kills.
Yeah.
And his sister as well. That's easy.
And his dad, because his dad's completely...
But...
would do anything for him.
But he doesn't ever strike... he doesn't really strike out against mother, does he? I mean, does... He
leaves her alive, as if, like... Because that's the worst fate he could give her.
Isn't it... I mean, couldn't it also be that he actually is powerless with his mother? He can't actually take out his rage on her. Because that would be the pattern. The one person that he does feel rage for is also the one he feels powerless in the presence of.
So
then he has to find surrogate outlets.
Yeah.
And because with Travis, one of the mysteries of Taxi Driver is why he just switches targets, like. And he picks one target that seems pretty random, really, just that he's pissed off with Betsy and then she likes him and the guy got into his cab and was a bit of a dick, but basically there isn't really anything, it's just, he just needs a mission. Shaves his head and everything and feels like, but then he fails at that because he's all scatterbrained, and then he just zeroes in on the next, not even logical, but the next convenient target. Which, I mean, he does, he's obviously angry about the way Sport talks about Iris, because he says that to Iris, you know, he talked about you and called you names. So there's something there that, that triggers it.
Yeah.
But his relationship with Sport there.
But I mean, it's more than just shifting targets, because he goes from doing something that would, you know, have him down as terrorist to hero.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a massive difference. Where it's not just parallel.
No. Yeah. No, but he's, I mean, and also in the first act he's trying to get at Betsy, the woman.
Mm.
In the second act he's trying to avenge, in his own mind, Iris, who's the child.
Yeah. But it does, I mean, you do feel like it doesn't feel that random, in the sense that he does actually feel something. Feel like he does, like, want to, what am I trying to say, Iris.
Yeah, he does want to help her.
Yeah.
Yeah, he wants to get her out of that life.
Yeah.
And she awakens something in him, because he connects to her, he can't connect to Betsy.
Yeah.
Because she's not, whatever, on his level.
Yeah.
And she's a fantasy.
Yeah.
Iris belongs to Travis's world of porno and all that. So he actually has a real connection with her.
Yeah.
We see him, he's acting like himself.
Yeah.
And he wants her to go to... I know she's talking about a commune. But anyway, he wants her to get out of the life.
Mm.
So it's somewhat... There's a certain logic to it, but don't you get the sense that really he just needs an outlet?
Yeah.
And he finds it.
Mm.
And the rest is sort of secondary at best.
Yeah. What was our point?
That Travis, like all these other characters, that he's carrying around decades of rage. And we got, specifically with Travis, we've got the Vietnam War, which I know it's not referred to, but it's implicit. And that's... There's a sort of sense about the Vietnam War that the American GIs were powerless there.
Mm.
They were powerless to fight it. The Viet Cong were numerous and invisible, and basically it was a disaster as a war. And they felt betrayed as well by their own government and by the people when they came back and so on. So you can see how there's a certain template there for how Travis experienced powerlessness, you know, in his experience in the war. But presumably it would go further back. And so he's carrying around this rage and needs to find an object. We started on the thing of sadists, like what makes a sadist.
Mm.
And, you know, all of these models... It seems Kevin, Frank, my own thing. There aren't that many, but those anyway. It seems to be Rage Against the Mother.
Norman Bates.
It's the classic.
Yeah.
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 So I do think there's something in that.
Mm.
In terms of the original experience of powerlessness, being an infant with its mother.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, a father can abuse an infant too, but...
But I mean, with Kevin, it starts in the womb.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I wonder if we can tie this together to this thing about feelings, because one of the things I think about the rage against the mother, I think it has to do, and I'm talking about male children, because violent psychopaths will have you generally male. Individuals who try to find an identity through violence, it's another way of describing it.
Yeah.
They tend to be male, that's a male thing. I think part of it is that an infant who has a very strong mother, or strong is not the word, but oppressive maternal presence in some way, it can be like they can't actually have their own feelings because their mother's feelings overwhelm them.
Yeah.
And like the mother is, it's like the mother is using the infant as an extension of herself, or trying to maintain that symbiotic union. So all of the infant's feelings are being controlled by the mother, or monitored, or I mean, this isn't just male children, because Michelle, my wife, had this experience with her mother, that her feelings were constantly monitored and controlled by her mother.
Mm.
And this brings it to narcissism, which I wanted to get to, because I think that another spectrum that intersects with psychopathy is narcissism, which is a kind of inability to see or acknowledge the other.
Yeah.
So something, if you can't acknowledge it's the interiority of the other. Since this is autism and theory of mind, but like, and this is how you described your friend, that you sort of observe him and you can't find anything there.
Mm. Well, it's completely blank.
It seems like he's empty.
Mm.
And I do think, I wanted to get to that as well, like empty. I think there are people who are somehow empty in a way that is not healthy, and that I think that relates to what we think of as psychopaths. But anyway, the way you perceive him may be the way that he perceives everyone else.
Yeah.
Because he just can't, and it would be, I mean, if he doesn't have an interiority, then he wouldn't be able to imagine anyone else does, and vice versa.
Yeah.
If he can't imagine anyone having an interiority, then he can't generate one for himself.
Mm. Yeah.
So then what happens, I think, is that, because people who are like that, they still experience another, because they're physically aware of the presence, they kind of see them as just dolls.
Mm.
Like empty shells that they can just manipulate.
Yeah.
And there may even be something where they want to make them feel pain so that they can get a reaction from them and feel like they're alive, and then they feel like they're alive.
I mean, I do feel like he is trying to get something out of me. Like, whether it's trying to make me feel one thing or another, like he's trying to get something out of me.
Right.
Like, it's like seeing how far you can push something.
Mm-hmm.
But in a very benign way, but still.
Like, what's an example?
So, just when I don't feel like he does fancy me, but, like, trying to, just flirting with me to the extent that,
right,
like, to see where I'll cut it off, or like being overly tactile when it's not like unnecessary, so it doesn't feel like it doesn't feel just caring, it just feels like just trying to see how far you can push it.
It's like he wants to somehow test
the
reality and test if he's having an effect on it.
Yeah. Exactly.
Right, so that's, that brings back to narcissism again. This friend specifically who's saying he wants you to find out if you fancy him. So it's like, that's obviously narcissistic. He doesn't even fancy you, but he wants to see if he can get you to fancy him. So then it's like, he doesn't feel real, and he's trying to have a sense of existing.
Mm.
by getting a response from the other.
Yeah, it's just trying to... It's like going through the motions. Just going through the motions without being there. And then just... So it's not... It doesn't feel natural. It doesn't feel at all natural or at all real. It's just like pushing it just to see. Or doing something just to see what will happen.
Mm-hmm.
In, like I said, like a very benign way now, because it's just flirting or...
Benign, you mean kind of neutral.
You mean not killing people.
Yeah, you mean neutral, I think.
Yeah.
Not actually benevolent or...
No, benign, doesn't benign mean...
Well, benign, the roots, is good, so it definitely implies something positive as opposed to just something harmless.
Yeah.
You're suggesting that it's harmless. But it doesn't sound very pleasant to be around.
No, it's not. It never feels unpleasant. I feel bored sometimes, but it's never... I never feel...
Do you never feel that as well as trying to get something out of you, that he's trying to put something in you?
What do you mean?
Make you feel something.
Or if he isn't very good at it.
Yeah.
So.
Well, he might be better with other people.
Yeah, I just think he is.
So then, he might be as good as he needs to be, and he might be drawn to you because he can't quite.
Yeah.
Get his.
I think that is. Yeah, I'm completely. I think we're only still friends because. I don't fancy him. Like, I don't think we'd be friends if I didn't fancy him.
Wait, if you did fancy him?
If I did fancy him, yeah.
You wouldn't be friends. Is that because he would have had sex with you and then cast you off?
Wouldn't even necessarily have had sex with me, just that I wouldn't ever have been interested.
What?
Just that he wouldn't ever have been interested.
He wouldn't. Once he'd ascertained that he could get you to fancy him, he'd have just moved on to the next sort of verification point.
Yeah.
Right, so you've observed him going through people like that.
Yeah, completely.
He gets women to, or girls to fancy him, and then he just drops them.
Not even gets, I mean a lot of people do.
They do, he just checks that they do.
Yeah.
But if they don't, he'll try and charm them.
Yeah.
And what about, is he a sexual predator as well, or is it just...
No, because he has this idea of morality, so he wants to have a girlfriend... And this will be his girlfriend until she gets bored and breaks up with him, which happened recently. And then he'll try and find a new girlfriend. And then, which is, I mean, like Harrison, my ex-boyfriend, was the same. He would have a girlfriend until she broke up with him and then find a new one. But he'd never break up with someone. But, But yeah, so he doesn't do anything that would conventionally be considered, bad,
irresponsible,
or
callous.
Yeah, exactly, because he wants to be just sort of perfect and good and attractive and fanciable and have a perfect life with a girlfriend and,
Can you imagine him crying?
No.
Does he laugh?
Yeah, but...
Does it feel like a real laugh?
No.
Or just an affected kind?
No. Occasionally.
Yeah.
I think it would feel real, but...
Does he appear to suffer in any way, or does he talk as if he's suffering?
Sometimes says he feels upset about something or other, but no, it doesn't feel real.
What about lonely?
No.
Does he like a robot?
Yeah, pretty much.
Like an advanced synthetic android model.
Yeah.
First off the line. Kind of.
Yeah, exactly.
Alright. Have you considered that possibility?
Yeah, no.
You haven't? I mean, I wouldn't seriously suggest it, but I wouldn't rule it out either. There is something online that people who read my blog they occasionally comment on. It's quite popular within the margins, called organic portals, and it's about people on the planet who, for whatever reason, I would say trauma, are, I guess you'd say, soulless.
Mm.
They're like physically here, but there's no soul. There's no attachment to any sort of soul or psyche. So they're like these empty vessels. And then other things move in and kind of use them as, I don't want to scare you here, because obviously it's a very literalized, it's not a psychological model.
Mm.
Although, I mean, there are overlaps with psychological models. But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I could say, well, I do think there are people like that, but there wouldn't be any point in saying that if I couldn't think of an example. Like, I told you about Peter, but, I mean, I like Peter. He seemed like a nice guy, really. So I wouldn't want to use him as an example, really. He did have some of those qualities, just seeming kind of a bit vacant. But I've no doubt, that really, that there are people who are really majorly vacant. And maybe this is bringing us just the question of this, your question of this idea that of a psychopath who's just kind of empty and feels nothing, what would drive them? And the answer, if there is such a thing, is that they get possessed by something outside of them. And then that drives them. And I think there is something in this in terms of, like, if somebody's really, really badly traumatized as a child and the elements line up in such a way that they just vacate the premises, really. Like, let's say soul, because I think there's such a thing as a soul. So we can talk about it later if you disagree or you don't know what I mean. But anyway, that the soul just, it doesn't, not only does it not land in the body, because I think that doesn't happen with any of us at this point in evolution or society, what have you, but it really just gets pushed away or just flees the premises because the circumstances are so terrible. And then the nature abhors a vacuum. And this is sort of a chicken or an egg thing, because one of the reasons that such intense trauma is happening physically for that person is that the parents or siblings or other adults around or older children are actually abusing that person, that child, and using it as a poison container, as in, like I was saying about people who just see other people as dolls. like a plaything. I mean, that's how Sebastian viewed me. At least one psychic said that. I think it might be quite accurate. Saw me as a plaything when I was a baby. That so then this child is like being used as an object to take out rage and anger and on, and actually to put stuff in energetically that is driving that abuser into rage and into those actions. So then it's like that person becomes possessed by the very same patterns of rage, powerlessness, and fear that caused the abuse to begin with. So then, I mean, your experience of this guy is not that, it's just that he's empty, but as I say, nature abhors a vacuum, so if he's empty, the chances are that something has gone in to fill that emptiness, even if it's not obvious what it is. And I mean, the clues are in, well, the clues are in everything he does, but one of the clues I would say is like his drive to create this perfect relationship.
It's a perfect life, really.
That whole thing, yeah.
So with the brunette girlfriend and the right degree, I guess, and by extension, job, and probably children and house.
Yeah.
Is what I expect.
Dog.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So he's trying to, I would say, he's trying to create circumstances that he didn't get, didn't see. Like, maybe it might be partly imitative. His parents might be like that in the sense that they also kept, had a surface kind of order and whatnot, but underneath was a seething morass of rage and hatred. Or it could have just been all out in the open and he was just surrounded by awful circumstances and so he just wanted to go to the other extreme. But either way, it sounds as though he's pathologically driven to create circumstances that he himself was denied as a child. You have that thought? Like robotically driven.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's like he's become, he's been voided of everything but this goal.
Yeah. It's just the problem is that he isn't that driven. Like
Well, he wouldn't be because it's it's not even his him.
Yeah.
He's not being driven by his soul, so there's no passion,
yeah.
inspiration,
yeah.
no real energy.
Yeah.
It'd just be like a marionette. I mean, what, and maybe his parents are, I mean, so maybe I'll just be saying the same thing in a different way, I don't know, but he may be possessed by the desires of his parents, but they want, at some level, they want to have this perfect son who has the perfect wife and the perfect job and all those things. Does he even like his parents?
I don't think he likes anything. Like he just.
Does he claim to?
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't claim. He claims to have a very like, ordinary relationship with his parents, which is.
Which would be a bad relationship.
Which would be he doesn't tell them everything, and they don't, you know, they don't hang out.
Yeah.
That they get on fine.
Right. Does he respect them?
As far as I know, yeah.
Well. So, yeah, I was thinking, as a case study, obviously you've already decided he's interesting, but specifically, he sounds like... I guess what I called in Maitri Swara a humaton. Did you read Maitri Swara?
No.
But I was trying to think of a movie, because I'm sure there's a movie or two that's like this. Somebody's just trying to be the perfect citizen. Well, there's a stepfather, but he's a psycho. Have you seen Stepfather?
No.
Oh, you would love that movie.
What was the movie you told me to watch as well?
Interesting, because I told you to watch The Player. I said you would really like The Player, and I wrote about them in the same chapter in Blood Poets. I twinned them, so they both come up. So I recommend, could almost do it while I'm here, but we don't have time, a double bill of Stepfather and The Player. Okay. And they're both about ordinary men who are actually psychopaths, or psychopaths who, well, yeah, one is a psychopath who pretends to be an ordinary man, the other is a seemingly ordinary guy who's actually, he's really a psychopath. He doesn't realise it, but anyway, but that wasn't exactly what I was thinking of in terms of your friend, but that, like, it's like a magnification of the socialised human who is driven to create a perfect life based on the criteria that society has given to them, the values of what a perfect life consists of. And because to really embody that, you have to be completely emptied out of any internal qualities and just become a carrier for social values. And it, so it's, it is like becoming a robot.
Yeah.
And that is, I think, the closest you get to being to a psychopath. Somebody's completely hollowed out and kind of machine-like.
So that would fit my original definition.
It does, yeah.
And wouldn't necessarily be someone that ended up killing people.
I think there are worse things you can do than kill people, number one.
Yeah, but that's what most psychopaths end up doing. I mean, most of that definition of psychopaths, as in...
Is that we know that they're psychopaths?
Our idea of psychopaths is people that kill people up, rage.
Well, see, now we get into a difficult area, because we could say that a successful psychopath is one who doesn't kill people, because they're CEOs and presidents and prime ministers and so on. Yeah, as in they've channeled that predatorial, power-hungry, cold, calculating, completely devoid of empathy. All of that, they've channeled it into simply scaling the social pyramid. But if we acknowledge that, we allow that, then we have to actually allow, while politicians do kill people, they certainly have people killed, and the stuff that I've researched, which is that the people who become powerful in society, yes, they do suppress in a sense, or conceal their psychopathic tendencies, so that people think they're upstanding citizens. But part of that, I believe, is that they have a secret society, like a subculture that's actually a superculture, because it rules over our world, where they do practice the most abominable actions, where they murder children and torture and do the most horrific things possible. But they do it within their own clique, where it's that's the moral thing to do. They have an inverted morality. You're nodding. I mean, it's quite like it's a horrific thing to describe. And we haven't talked about it before, but you're nodding like it's familiar to you from me.
I don't think we haven't talked about it.
You don't think we haven't talked about it? So you think we have?
Yeah.
You just chose the double negative there.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. I mean, haven't we?
We've certainly touched on it quite a lot with all the nice...
this kind of thing.
Yeah.
I'm not surprised when that kind of thing comes into conversation with you.
Yeah. Well, I'm not surprised that you're not surprised, but I'm not sure if I've stated it as baldly as I just did. Maybe I have. So then what do you think about that? Like,
what do you mean?
Well, I mean, it's familiar to you somewhat as an idea or as a possibility that you associate with me. But what do you think about it in terms of your own experience and your own perceptions about the world?
As in, how real do I think it is? Or
anything like that, yeah. You must have some thoughts about it.
Well, I don't know, because the only idea that I really have is from you. So I guess I haven't really come across it at all anywhere outside of you. So I don't have anything to go by apart from what you tell me.
Well, sure. So yeah, you would want to do research before you made it mine about how...
Well, but also I've grown up just believing most things that you say, so...
Right. So that's included in that.
Yeah.
So then how does it square with the things that you believe or even know just from your own experience and your own perception of the world? Like, does that fit with your general perception of the world, or does it pull the rug out from under it? Or?
I think my perception of the world would probably be quite different if you weren't my uncle.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, I think a lot of my understanding of how dark everything is, everything can be in the world, comes from you, and probably would be quite different. But, I mean, yeah, I don't, but I can't imagine that because that isn't the case, so.
Right. Well, you do have Pluto conjunct Sun. So there's a chicken or an egg thing there too, because there are other nieces or whatever, other, you know, if I'd known somebody else who was, you know, from birth to age 20 and hung out with her just as much, she wouldn't necessarily have taken on any of this stuff.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have talked about it also. Like, I'm even when you're 1 year old, I'm responding to you and what seems to be what you're receptive to, and so that's continuing to this day. So the fact even that I've shared these things with you implies that you were receptive.
Yeah.
Like, I knew that at some level that you could handle them, and it wouldn't cause you to obsess or think I was too weird to hang out with, or any number of possible, you know, undesirable outcomes. So then it isn't just about you're a blank slate and I'm riding on it.
Yeah, I think, I mean, do you know what exactly is the question?
There wasn't a question, I was just shifting the emphasis a bit from all on me to half on you.
I think I don't know, but I think my ability to hear and understand that kind of darkness is about as much as hearing it from you. And then generally accepting it, that.
Mm-hmm.
But not taking it on, but not anything further, but not going anything further.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Well, it sounds like a sort of placeholder.
What do you mean?
Well, a placeholder is when you put something on the seat so that no one else sits on it, because you're going to sit on it at some point. Yeah. So it's like you kept that place open. Jason talked about these things. A lot of what he says seems pretty reliable, so maybe that is too, but I'm not going to get to it just yet.
Yeah, I guess so.
I would also wonder, it's not just about how reliable you consider me to be as a source of insight and whatnot, but also your felt sense of what the world is like. So if I said something, because I could say something about eating meat, it doesn't matter, it's me that says it, it just doesn't square with how you feel. So when something comes to you that really goes against your felt sense, then you don't place keep it, you just knock it right, sweep it right off the table. So you didn't do that with this, so then it suggests that it does square more or less with your sense of the world.
I guess so, yeah. I don't know, because things like... I don't know, because I come to... I have very strong ideas about certain things. I don't know if it, I guess the question is whether it squares with my sense of the world or if it doesn't not square, if you know what I mean. Like it doesn't, like with...
Yeah, it doesn't conflict with it.
Yeah, so...
Yeah, but that's the same, really. I mean, there's a marginal area between and whatnot. Yeah. But generally, if it doesn't conflict with your view of the world, then it kind of squares with it.
Yeah, I guess so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you are a person who would like the world to end, so there's presumably some reason for that.
Yeah, it's true. No, it's true. I hate the world. Yeah. So, yeah.
My fault, I still don't believe you. Oh, 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 Arkansas. We both know this was a mistake. I'd love to come home, but I need an escape. Oh, 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 Arkansas. Fade out. This is where the credits roll our name. Taller than trees and brighter than starlight. I never feel magic unless I'm with you. Oh, 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 Arkansas. Tell me you mean it when you tell me you love me. I wanna believe you. I wanna believe you. Oh, 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 Arkansas. Fade out. This is where the credits roll on. You said it's my fault. I still don't believe you. Oh, 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 Arkansas. Tell me you mean it when you tell me you love me. I wanna believe you. I wanna believe you. Oh, 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 Arkansas. This is where the credits roll our name.
So I have a question for you then, because I think this is very interesting for me, because for obvious reasons, because it's about me. You're saying that a lot of your sense of how dark things are has come from me. But obviously there was a point, like, you've known me for your whole life, so there was a point where I wasn't talking about dark stuff with you, obviously, when you're 1, 2, 3 years, and so on. I wasn't talking about satanic elite or anything like that. But is your experience of me consistent in this regard? Like, can you talk at all about the influence that I've had in your life from when you can remember it to present?
Yeah, no, I don't. But then I think you've changed as well. Mm. As in, you haven't looked at least this version of darkness, this version of how dark the world is. You haven't been looking into. You weren't looking into when I was a child.
Not as deeply, no. Nowhere near as deeply.
No. So, I mean, that's different. Yeah. I think I've always thought of you as the first one to question things.
Yeah.
I think the first 15 or so years, it was, I associated you, well, I still do, but I think my biggest association with you, was with just magic.
And what did magic mean to you over that period, those 15 years? Because presumably that changed as well. I mean, because when you were very young, it was fairies and
teaching me to fly and levitate and
sort of serious games.
Yeah, and Marianne dreams.
Lucid dreaming came in later as getting more actual practical. Did that have a dark quality to it, would you say?
What?
The magic.
obviously can't remember a time where I ever thought of magic as something that was only good. I think, I assume that I have just, I mean, mum always ended, stories that ended and they lived happily ever after, mum would always correct to happily and unhappily ever after. Like, I've never had an idea of magic as being just good.
Right.
That wouldn't just be you.
Yeah, very well.
So I think, I mean, maybe deep would be a better word than dark.
Yeah. I would agree with that. As deep as dark, generally, the deeper you go, the darker it gets. But that's, necessary if you want to go deep. Can you describe what difference it made believing in magic, or what it meant to you, like, growing up as somebody who believed in magic, in a sense.
Past a normal age? All children believe in magic, don't they?
No. I don't know. I mean
all children believe in
Santa Claus, and I didn't know.
The Tooth Fairy.
But allowing for the difference. I mean, we know there's a difference because I was serious. I wasn't just humouring a kid.
I suppose. What difference? What was the question?
Like, have you thought about how in your life it actually kind of bled into your interactions and shaped your personality, or just what a difference it made?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a huge part of who I am is believing in magic, because I don't know. I don't know.
Well, I don't want to put words in your mouth. Like, I mean, the first thing I thought of before was, you know, how you've dealt with fear in your life, nightmares, stuff like that. Like, you know, the dark side of magic, or the deep side, or both. Is that it can make, I mean, knowing about it can make fears seem more real. As in, there really is a monster under the bed, or there really could be.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. The other thing was empowerment. Like, if you feel like magic is real and the imagination can articulate or express or change and so on, then that's sort of the flip side of that. It's back to power and powerlessness there. So, I mean, like when you didn't get into the college you wanted to get into recently, I got the sense from that part of the thing that was hard for you was that you felt that the signs had been indicating you would, and that you'd been doing everything right, and your magic had failed in some way.
Mm. Yeah.
So that would be an example of how that changed.
Yeah, but I mean, it's like, that was the difficult part, but at the same time, it did, as it always has done, touch wood for me, it did all still come together in a way that felt quite magic, like,
sure,
that wouldn't have come together in that way if I had, like, it literally, I would have, if I had, I wouldn't have then gone on, I would have cancelled my audition at Leeds.
Yeah.
Because I wouldn't have wanted to go up to Leeds.
Yeah.
And then I wouldn't have got the scholarship.
Yeah.
So.
Right, so.
There was no way of me, like, I wouldn't have, if I had gone to Goldsmiths, I would have accepted it straight away.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't have.
Right, so you're saying your faith was restored in the end.
Yeah, I guess.
But my point was more that how you had a different experience around that because of your belief in magic. As just an example of how you experience daily life differently because you're seeing it through a certain lens.
Yeah.
And how that could have positive and negative.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot in daily life and the way we think that really isn't magical, or at least doesn't allow for a magical perspective. There's also, and this is, might be too many points at once, but, you know, magical thinking, which I've used in a positive sense, needless to say, in lucid view and whatnot, but it has a negative meaning, you know, even as a diagnosis. Did you know that?
Yeah,
magical thinking is a term for is used as a term for a symptom of schizophrenia or a certain kind of psychosis, as in people would believe that, well, because Sebastian was like this, like if he didn't turn the light switch on and off 25 times before bed, something bad would happen the next day. And that can be paralyzing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not that different from Christians. I think if they don't go to confession, they go to hell.
Yeah.
Which obviously has a massive toll on people's lives.
Yeah.
But anyway, I mean, the main question here is, because I think it'd be interesting to people who listen to the podcast, is what it was like having me as an uncle in terms of... in any terms, really, but just in terms of how it shaped your perspective and your perception now, because now you've grown up, in quotes.
Mm.
And I did that in quotes, not just because you're not really grown up, but because the whole idea of grown up is it's kind of a, don't know how meaningful it is. Anyway, so now you're on your own, really. You've assembled your worldview. I mean, hopefully it will collapse gracefully and you'll be able to, you know, the butterfly will come out of the chrysalis and you'll keep transforming. But for the meantime, as you get off to college and all that, you're going to want a more or less stable.
Mm.
Anyway, and we've already seen how you really have strong convictions about certain things to a fault, I would say, as in needing to have something stable. So, I don't know if there's anything you want to say about that. Because, of course, sorry to interrupt if you're heading for a thought, but one of the things that changed about when you turned 15, not exactly, but around that time, was I started saying, well, actually, I don't believe in magic anymore.
Did you?
Oh, I thought you knew that, because I remember Ashley saying, like, oh, what will Emma say? Or no, it came up in Canada when you were there. Like, so, yeah, I mean, well, and specifically part of me going deeper into dark stuff is recognizing that occultism and sorcery are, well, there isn't really much of a good side to them. It's mostly pretty dark, I discover, and I mean, fortunately, I never really adhered to any specific belief systems. But so it's not believing in magic as in not believing that it's real, but ceasing to believe that it's a good path.
Yeah, but I've never seen magic as a path, more just like the other day, like saying the prayer to Saint Anthony.
Yeah.
And then obviously in my everyday astrology.
Yeah.
In my everyday, and just as something that exists outside of me.
Outside or inside?
Well, both, but I guess by outside I mean outside of, like, I'm not following it.
Yeah.
It would be following me.
Following you, or what? Like,
just something that exists in the world rather than something that, like, with sorcery, something that people
do. Yeah. Yeah.
Which I don't not believe in, but you know more about than me. And
you were never, unlike some of your friends back in the day, I remember in Farnham, Jackie and whatnot, you never aspired to be a witch in that sort of cheesy conventional way.
No, I just appreciate just magic in life, I guess, just in things that happen that around me.
Mm-hmm. And within you.
Yeah.
So what would be a synonym for magic, or how would you define magic the way you're talking about it?
I don't know.
We can always edit the pauses. You can't say I don't know.
I don't know. Magic. Why do I need two words?
What?
Why do I need two words?
Well, you don't have to find a synonym, but define it to somebody who doesn't know what you're talking about.
Just if science is like the mind, then magic's like the body. Like, it doesn't we don't have to understand it. Like, it just, we can feel it, and it treats itself, and that's how it works.
How about an intelligent system?
Yeah.
Was that close to?
Yeah.
And that we're inside of it, but also it's inside of us.
Yeah.
So then the inside and the outside is like one continuum.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's... I mean, of course, I put lots of words in your mouth there, but assuming that I didn't misrepresent what you were saying, that is more or less what I would say. I did say it. I'm going to keep talking about it, I think we'll probably end a minute ago or so, but that's actually paganism, what we're talking about, and it's a funny thing because there's something about, and I think maybe you were getting this, there's something about magic that the moment you start to practice it, it ceases to be magic.
Mm.
Because then you're doing it, and doing it with the mind, and the mind just...
Well, it's kind of how I feel about my prayers to St. Anthony, is that
yeah.
I say something, or I say a prayer, or I like, have a connection with St. Anthony, or whatever, with magic, if I really need it. But then as soon as I start to think, shit, that always works, let's do it again, when I've lost my hairbrush.
Yeah.
Like, I almost know, for one thing, know that it wouldn't work. But I just know that it wouldn't really be, I wouldn't be treating that as magic anymore. I'd be treating it as something that I'm trying to
using the will,
rather than, yeah.
Well, my experience with the St. Anthony prayer and my passport was that, I mean, it wasn't that I half did it, because I don't believe in doing things by halves, but that, I guess it was that I was acknowledging a part of me that would say the prayer without really being that invested in it or interested. Like, okay, I'm going to say a prayer now, but I'm not going to, make it all formal and all that, invocations. And, I think, in retrospect at least, the meaning of the prayer for me was letting go of the need to get the passport back, saying, it's up to you, say, it's in your hands, and I'm just going to carry on and just...
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Rather than,
you've got to do it! Anthony, yeah. Come on, Anthony!
Mm. Right, so it's paradoxical. Because the thing that you're praying for, you're letting go of the desire for it.
Mm.
The prayer is you're letting go.
Yeah.
I think that's real magic. Let's just say it's not, it's to not practice it.
Mm.
But to hand it over to something else.